coordinator for the Vaccine Policy Collaborative Initiative with the Children's Outcome Research Program at the University of Colorado in Denver. And the title of Christine's presentation is Are Primary Care Physicians Following Interim Recommendations for the Use of HIV Vaccine During the Shortage?
Thank you, Tammy. As Tammy mentioned, I am going to present a national survey that we conducted looking at physician knowledge and practice regarding the use of HIV vaccine during recent shortages. The authors do not have anything to disclose. Haemophilus influenzae type B, or HIV disease, primarily occurs in infants and children under the age of 5 years old. Invasive HIV infection can cause meningitis, pneumonia, sepsis, epiglottitis, otitis media, skin infections, and arthritis. Currently in the United States, HIV disease primarily occurs in under-immunized children and infants, and these include children and infants that have not been immunized due to parental refusal or infants that have not completed the primary series. 3 to 6% of cases are fatal, and up to 20% of surviving patients do have other long-term side effects such as hearing loss. The HIV vaccine was licensed in 1987 and was recommended for all U.S. infants since 1991. Since the licensure of the vaccine, incidence of invasive HIV disease has decreased by 99%. There are two manufacturers of the vaccine that each have different dosing schedules and formulations. The first one is Merck that produces PEDVAX, HIB, and COMVAX, which is a combination vaccine of hepatitis B and HIB. The Merck vaccines is a two-dose primary series given at 2 and 4 months, and then a booster dose given at 12 to 15 months. Sanofi Pasteur is the other manufacturer of the vaccine that produces ACT-HIB and the newly licensed Pentasil. Again, another combination vaccine including HIB, DTaP, and IPV. This is a three-dose primary series given at 2, 4, and 6 months, and then a booster dose at 12 to 15 months. In December of 2007, Merck voluntarily recalled about 1 million doses of certain lots of HIV vaccine due to concerns about the sterility of the equipment used during manufacturing. This, of course, led to nationwide shortages. In response to these shortages, the CDC's ACIP issued interim recommendations to defer the HIV booster in healthy 12 to 15-month-old children and to continue giving the primary series for all children and a booster dose in high-risk 12 to 15-month-olds. Currently, shortages are expected to continue through mid-2009. During late 2008 and early 2009 in the states of Minnesota and Pennsylvania, 10 children between the ages of 5 months and 4 years old were reported with invasive HIV disease, and 3 of these were fatal. The data does suggest that most cases of HIV disease occurred in children that were not fully vaccinated, again, due to parental refusal or the child being too young to complete the primary series. So the objectives of this study was to determine in a nationally representative sample of pediatricians and family medicine physicians their knowledge and attitudes about CDC's interim recommendations, their current practice regarding HIV vaccine administration, and finally, factors that are associated with not adhering to recommendations. The study population consisted of physicians in an existing sentinel network through the Vaccine Policy Collaborative that was developed through the University of Colorado Denver in collaboration with the Centers for Disease Control. Pediatricians were recruited from a random sample from the American Academy of Pediatrics, and family medicine physicians were recruited from a random sample from the American Academy of Family Physicians. We did quota sampling to ensure that all of our networks were similar to the overall AAP and AAFP memberships. A previous study that we conducted compared the Sentinel Network physicians to physicians that were randomly selected or sampled from the American Medical Association, which is currently the most commonly used method to survey physicians. The work showed that Sentinel Network physicians were comparable to the AMA sample with respect to physician demographics, practice characteristics, as well as responses regarding key vaccine-related issues. The survey was administered during April of 2008, and this was 4 months after the interim recommendations were in place. Due to the timeliness of the issue, the survey was only administered to Sentinel Network members who agreed to be surveyed by email, and this consisted of about two-thirds of each of our networks. Participants received an initial email with a link to the internet survey and up to 3 additional email reminders. 60% of physicians responded to the survey. We see that more pediatricians at 68% versus 51% of family medicine physicians responded. 18 family medicine physicians who don't immunize children under the age of 2 were excluded from analyses. Generally, respondents were similar to non-respondents with respect to physician and practice characteristics. However, there were 2 exceptions. Family medicine physicians who responded were less likely to be male than non-respondents, and pediatricians who responded had a higher participation in VFC than non-respondents. So when we asked physicians if they were aware of interim recommendations, pediatricians were more likely at 98% than family medicine physicians at 81% to be aware of interim recommendations. Of those physicians that were aware, 100% of pediatricians and 99% of family medicine physicians understood to defer the HIB booster in healthy 12 to 15-month-olds. We then asked physicians where they received the information from regarding the interim recommendations. 93% of pediatricians received that information from the American Academy of Pediatrics, and 59% of family medicine physicians received the information from their respective local or state health department. When assessing attitudes regarding interim recommendations, family medicine physicians were more likely at 37% than pediatricians at 21% to strongly or somewhat agree that interim recommendations were unclear. Pediatricians at 60% were more likely than family medicine physicians at 39% to strongly or somewhat agree that patients who have received the primary series of the HIV vaccine will not be adequately protected until they receive their booster dose of the vaccine. We then asked physicians if they reported having a shortage in their practice. 73% of pediatricians and 45% of family medicine physicians reported that they did experience a shortage in their practice that required deferral of doses. When looking at HIB vaccine administration practices, we see here that 21% of pediatricians and 31% of family medicine physicians reported giving the booster to healthy 12 to 15-month-olds. Again, this goes against CDC's recommendations to defer to this group, and therefore these physicians were not non-adherent. 97% of pediatricians and 99% of family medicine physicians reported giving to 12 to 15-month-olds with high-risk conditions, and these physicians were correctly adhering to recommendations. Additionally, 87% of pediatricians and 89% of family medicine physicians reported giving the primary series to their 2, 4, and 6-month-old populations, again, adhering to the recommendations. We then looked at physicians that reported the need to defer any doses of the primary series in their 2 to 6-month-olds. Here we see that 19% of pediatricians and 35% of family medicine physicians reported deferring the primary series 1 to 9% of the time. What was more surprising is that pediatricians at 24% and 22% of family medicine physicians reported deferring the primary series at least 10% more of the time. So when we look at this, we see that 43% of pediatricians and 57% of family medicine physicians reported having to defer the primary series at some point in time in their practice. We then looked at factors that were associated with non-adherence to recommendations After adjusting for physician demographics and practice characteristics, as well as attitudes in current vaccine administration practice, pediatricians with an odds ratio of 101 versus family medicine physicians with an odds ratio of 11, these both groups were more likely not to adhere to recommendations if their practice has had sufficient supplies of the vaccine. Additionally, family medicine physicians with an odds ratio of 25 were more likely not to adhere to recommendations if they were unaware of the recommendations in the first place. So the strengths of the study was that this was the only national survey to assess attitudes and practice regarding HIB shortage. And in addition, physicians were surveyed during the HIB shortage, where recall bias would be less likely. Limitations include that physicians were only surveyed by email, although our prior work does suggest that email and mail responses do not differ from one another. Sentinel physicians also may differ from physicians overall, but again, as I had mentioned earlier, that our prior work does suggest that they are representative of physicians nationally. And finally, our survey results do represent reported practice, and actual practice was not observed. So in conclusion, most physicians were aware of CDC's interim recommendations and understood to defer the booster in healthy 12 to 15 month olds. When looking at current practice, the majority of pediatricians and close to half of family medicine physicians reported experiencing shortages in their practice, and over 20% of physicians reported deferring the primary doses in their 2 to 6 month olds at least 10% or more of the time. 20 to 30% of physicians were not adhering to recommendations. Pediatricians and family medicine physicians who reported having sufficient supplies of the vaccine were significantly more likely to be non-adherent. And additionally, family medicine physicians who reported not being aware of interim recommendations were also more likely to be non-adherent. So this brings us to some points of discussion regarding not adhering to the recommendations. This may include that some physicians may have a misinterpretation of these interim recommendations, where physicians believe that shortages may refer to supplies at the practice or their personal level rather than at a national level. In addition, there may be physicians who understand that shortages refer to supplies at the national level, but they may have a desire to use up vaccine supplies at their practice level, and this may be due to things such as the fact that physicians want to recoup their upfront costs of purchasing the vaccine. There may be poor mechanisms in place for vaccine redistribution. And finally, maybe some physicians believe that there's no need to ration the vaccine because of the belief that the shortages will be short-lived. There was also confusion regarding recommendations, and this may be related to the different dosing schedules and formulations. Again, as you recall, the vaccine that was pulled off the market during the shortage was a 2-dose primary series, and the one that is currently available is a 3-dose primary series. And finally, reported deferral of primary series is of concern and could be leading to increase of carriage of HIV bacteria and decrease in herd immunity, as suggested by the recent HIV outbreaks. So the study implications suggest that there is a need for continued clarification that interim recommendations are based on supplies at a national level rather than a personal or a practice level. There also need to be clarifications regarding the use of different HIB-containing vaccines, such as the newly licensed Pentasil, as this will help to decrease confusion about different dosing schedules and formulations that are currently available. Frequent updates regarding duration of shortages will also be helpful for physicians in planning to vaccinate in their own populations. And finally, there is a need to assure that the completion of the primary series in 2, 4, and 6 month olds is done in the face of prolonged shortages. And I would like to thank all of the collaborators at the Vaccine Policy Collaborative Initiative at the University of Colorado, Denver, especially the principal investigator, Dr. Allison Kemp, as well as all of our CDC collaborators. Thank you.
to all of our speakers for three great presentations, and now we'll open it up for questions.
Well, that last one was fascinating, but I'll come back to it in a second because I have just a couple very brief clarifying questions for Rita. You mentioned homeschool. Are homeschool kids not required to get vaccinated, or they're not covered by the exemptions? Or how does homeschool differ from public school?
I'm looking at my immunization counterpart. They're not required. They don't have to
file. They don't have to get vaccinated in the first place.
Mm-mm.
Okay. And do you have to have a religious reason for the conscientious objection, or you can simply say, I don't like vaccines?
It's just for reasons of conscience, which includes
so whatever
religious
it could be.
Beliefs.
All right. So all the rest of my questions are for Christine. Yeah, that's pretty fascinating. The more vaccine you have, the less likely you are to follow to vaccinate the primary series. Now, I don't know if you had the chance, when you saw your results, you went, what's going on? Did you go back and do some focus interviews or something to ask people why? I don't know if you had that chance, but obviously a question is, do they have enough vaccine precisely because they're not using it the way they're supposed to? And that's why they have, which is cause and which is effect?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. Unfortunately, we were unable to go. I mean, it's such a large group of physicians that we have through our Sentinel network. So unfortunately, we're not able to, and it's a national in scope, so we can't sit down with these physicians, unfortunately, and conduct these focus groups. And again, it was a brief four-page survey. But yeah, I mean, that is a very good question. I'm not quite sure.
Well, when this arises again, you don't have to focus survey everywhere. You can call telephone two people and ask them why. You know, I mean, it's something to think about. Second thing, this is kind of a mix of comments and questions. You did the survey early on, as you said. That was actually before Pentacell was licensed.
Mm-hmm.
So the availability of Pentacell or the impact of Pentacell on any of this would not be revealed by the survey.
Correct.
The other thing is that you mentioned the outbreaks in Minnesota and Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is mostly Philadelphia, and Minnesota and Philadelphia were both heavy PVAXIV COMVAX users, which raises two considerations. One of them you alluded to. These may be physicians who are particularly inadept at recognizing that you got to give three doses in the primary series, not two, with the currently available vaccines.
Correct.
Right? You know, that's enriched with people who don't know how to do that because
mm-hmm.
they were prior COMVAX, PVAXIV users. The second thing is that the Alaska outbreak, Galil and colleagues a decade ago that was reported, investigated by CDC, suggests that long-term protection with the COMVAX, PVAXIV vaccinees is lower than with other vaccines, and carriage reduction is lower.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that once you take away the boosters and you allow the population pressure to rise, that you see the outbreaks first and populations getting COMVAX, PVAXIV, is actually not surprising. It's consistent with past studies.
Right. Correct.
Hi, Allie Kemp from University of Colorado. These were all really interesting presentations and terrific. I had a couple of questions for Rita also. I'm wondering how much you can look at age in terms of the incidence of pertussis and also clustering around schools. Because some of the graphs looks like they were in adjacent areas. So I'm kind of wondering if the clustering around schools will be helpful in terms of understanding it.
I think that's what we're going to go back and look at. We do have CE data by school district, but we didn't have time to go look at that and how does it coincide with what we're seeing with our disease rates. So we will be looking at that further.
I have a question for Ms. Espinoza. I noticed that some of the counties, you know, in adjacent counties had some similar outbreak activities. Do you think that possibly some of the outbreaks may have occurred because of travel from one county to the next? In the school population, you know, they have lots of school activities mm-hmm. and many go to different counties to compete for various functions. And do you think that might have something to do with it?
We do see that. I mean, we see a lot of the neighboring and adjacent counties because of either maybe you live in one county but go to a school in a different county, and just the activities and integration that does happen and occur.
Hi, great talk. Just to clarify, Christine, when you were saying that the physicians with adequate supplies were not adhering, were you referring to the primary series or the booster dose? Because I think there's some confusion in the audience.
They were not adhering to the recommendations to defer the booster dose to 12 to 15-month-olds.
Hi, very nice, very nice panel, all great presentations. Question for Jessica on the Menacta breakthrough cases. Are you collecting any data on bactericidal antibody levels?
We are in the process of developing a protocol to go back to, we're going to either go back to the cases that have already happened or go prospectively from here to try to measure bactericidal assay.
Okay, and I also have a question for Jessica. I was wondering if you could put the 13 breakthrough cases into context by giving us an idea of how many doses of vaccine were distributed.
Sure. Through 2008, there's been over 22 million doses of vaccine distributed, which means there's been less than one breakthrough case per million doses distributed.